about Taylor series, using Taylor series to solve the heat equation. And let me just remind you what I said. The heat equation is UT or UXX. Okay? And we tried a Taylor series solution of the form U of X and T is equal to the sum from n equals 0 to infinity t to the n. Yeah, that's probably correct. So t to the n times a sub n of x. Okay? So that's the form that a Taylor series would take. And I gave you an initial condition. So this is where we ended last time. And what I said was that the Taylor series solution to this problem has the form U of X and T is the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, has a very pretty form. It is T to the n times f 2n of x, that is the 2nth derivative of f of x, divided by n factorial. OK? That's what I showed you. And just to emphasize a little bit of vocabulary, this is called a Cauchy problem. And in a Cauchy problem, what you do is you specify an initial condition for all x, OK? People are sleeping late on Wednesday, I guess. Was there a party last night or something? OK. OK, so this is, we talked about the Cauchy problem. Here's the initial condition. We assumed a form of this type for the Taylor series. And then we found the structure. We simply plugged into the differential equation, OK? And you followed all that, I hope, right? Now, does anybody know, however, I mean, this problem here, this Cauchy problem here, of course, is a trivial problem. I mean, it's one of the elementary problems that you teach. Does anybody know the exact solution to that problem? Closed form quadrature solution?
And the great bit whose variance is time,
right? I mean, you know, you can write down the exact answer as an integral. Do you know? Yeah. What's no boundary condition. Okay, so this is given for all x. That's why it's called the Cauchy problem. If there were a boundary condition, this would not be so simple. Okay? But this is true for all x. Okay? Yeah.
Can you just multiply that by an exponential?
Say it again?
Don't you just multiply that by an exponential in time?
Almost.
Negative exponential.
Almost. So the exact solution okay, and I'm not going to derive this for you, but you should know that there is an exact solution to the Cauchy problem for the heat equation, The exact solution is explicitly u of x and t is 1 over the square root of 4 pi t times the integral from minus infinity to infinity ds e to the minus x minus s squared over 4t times f of s. That's the exact solution, okay? And if you don't believe it, just take this and plug it into the differential equation, and you'll see the differential equation is true. And secondly, let t go to 0. And as t goes to 0, do you understand what happens? Why is it that this satisfies this initial condition? Can you say why?
We get a delta function that turns
good.
On.
Very, very good. OK. So in the limit as t goes to 0, this combination, 1 over the square root of t times e to the minus something over t, OK, as t goes to 0, that approaches a delta function. And it becomes a delta function of x minus s. And so if you then do the s integral, you get f of x. So that's how the initial condition is satisfied. So we satisfied the differential equation, satisfied the initial condition. That's the exact solution. Okay. So what I've been talking to you about is a very elementary problem, because you can solve it exactly. Okay. That's the answer. And this is the answer for any initial condition, f of s. Okay. And it's the answer so long as this integral exists. Okay. If this function f of s were singular, then this integral would not exist, and the solution wouldn't exist. Okay, but we're assuming that this integral exists. So that's the answer to this problem. It's not very subtle, and it's not very deep. Okay. But nevertheless, we were pretending we did not know the answer, so we looked for the answer in the form of a Taylor series. And what we did was to say, suppose we considered the possibility, suppose f of x is e to the minus x squared, okay, a nice smooth function. And what we found is that the Taylor series, this Taylor series here, ceases to converge when t is greater than 1/4, which is amazing. It's ridiculous, OK? But in fact, the Taylor series is telling us something really important and really subtle and deep, OK? What the Taylor series is saying, that because it's a Taylor series in t, it always converges in a circle in the complex t-plane, the complex t-plane. Or if you want to talk about the real t-axis, it converges in a line on the real t-axis centered about t equals 0. And the reason that the Taylor series stops converging at t equals 1/4 is not a problem at t equals 1/4, but rather a problem at t equals minus 1/4, which is very, very interesting. And physically, what is the problem here? The problem is that this, if it converged, would give the answer for positive t as well as for negative t. But you can't undiffuse. There's an arrow of time. Diffusion only goes forward, not backward, OK? And if we try to go backward, it's asking the question, what was the original heat distribution, temperature distribution, previously that evolved into this? Okay, and as you go backward in time, this distribution that looks, you know, like a Gaussian like this becomes sharper and sharper and sharper. And finally, it becomes singular at t equals minus 1/4. And you can't go back earlier than that, okay? Because nothing evolves into a singular distribution. Why is that? Because the heat equation is a smoothing process. Diffusion is a smoothing process. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, why would it not convert at t equals to 1/4 if it didn't converge at t equals to minus 1/4?
It doesn't converge at t equals 1/4.
Right, I mean, but why is that? You're saying that there's a problem with the Taylor series of t equals to 1 quarter.
Right.
And the source of the problem actually comes from t equals to minus 1 quarter.
Right.
So is that very...
This is a problem with Taylor series. I mean, as an example, suppose I gave you the function 1 over 1 plus x. Okay? Now, this function has a problem at x equals minus 1. But it doesn't have a problem at x equals plus 1. Okay? So if you draw a picture of this function, you know, the function as x increases, when x is 0, this function passes through 1, right? And it's gradually decreasing. It's a nice, smooth function. Now, at minus 1 over here, the function is blowing up. Okay? And it's singular at that point, and then it comes up from minus infinity. Okay? But if we expand this in a Taylor series, so this is the function. If we wish to represent this function using a Taylor series, the Taylor series has the form minus 1 to the n, x to the n. Where does this Taylor series converge? It must converge in a circle in the complex x-plane. Okay, and on the real, so here's the complex x-plane. Here's that singularity, and this is the circle. Okay, if we want to just talk about the real x-axis, this converges for x between 1 and minus 1, but it doesn't converge at 1, even though there's nothing wrong with the function at 1. Look at that. Function is nice and smooth and differentiable. No problem at all. Why is it that this Taylor series suddenly ceases to converge? Because that Taylor series is required to converge in a circle. A Taylor series doesn't converge in a square or a triangle or a rectangle or something like that, only a circle. So this and the edge of the circle, the radius of the circle, is determined by the distance to the nearest singularity. That's the problem with Taylor series. Okay? And I can give you one other, let me give you one other example. This is, this is the first example. Suppose f of x is e to the minus x squared. Let's do another example. Suppose f of x is 1 minus x squared to the minus 2/3. It's a kind of a strange function. Okay? A little bit funny looking. But is that an acceptable... You understand, this function is singular at x equals 1 and at x equals minus 1. You all see that, right? So the initial distribution of temperature looks like this. Here's minus 1, here's 1. This is reflection symmetric, okay? And it blows up, you know, at minus 1, and it blows up at plus 1, like that. Okay. However, this is an integrable singularity. So I can take this function and plug it. I just take this function right here, plug it into this formula, evaluate it, and I can let the heat diffuse. And as it diffuses at a later time, this will look like this. You know, it'll have a nice smooth bump and another nice smooth bump. And then, as it continues to diffuse, the heat will diffuse that way and that way, because heat always goes from where it's hotter to where it's colder. So this will cool off, this will warm up, and then eventually you'll have just a lump of heat in the middle, and it'll continue spreading out to infinity, and eventually everything, all the heat, will diffuse off to infinity, plus or minus infinity, and the temperature will approach zero. Okay? So this is perfectly acceptable. On the other hand, what happens if we take this and plug this into this Taylor series formula? Well, let's see. Let's do a side. I think that's a nice exercise. Let's do a side calculation. We need to figure out what is the 2nth derivative of this. So to do that, let me expand this in a series. So if you have 1 minus a to the minus 2/3, let's see what series this represents. Let's just use a binomial expansion. So the first term in the first, small a. Okay, let's take a very small, take a binomial expansion. What's the first term? 1, okay. Second term? Plus, right. plus 2/3 a. And the next term? Okay, it would be 2/3 times 5/3 over 2 factorial times a squared plus 2/3 times 5/3 times 8/3 over 3 factorial times a cubed, and so on. Okay, that's the binomial expansion. Okay, now let's see, we can write this in a compact way. We could write this as the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, and you can see obviously the nth term has an a to the n and has an n factorial, but how do you get the 2/3, 2/3, 5/3, 2/3, 5/3, 8/3? That looks like, what were you saying? It looks like a gamma function, right? This is a gamma function of n plus 2/3 over gamma of 2/3. Okay, a gamma function is a factorial, okay? And this is the exact form of the series, okay? So therefore, if I have this function here, this function is the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, gamma of n plus 2/3 over gamma of 2/3, 1 over n factorial. And here, a is x squared, right? So this would be x to the 2n, okay? Now, suppose we ask the following question. What is, just from this Taylor series, what is u of 0 and t? In other words, I'm asking, what is the temperature at the origin for all time? Okay? So I have to take the 2nth derivative of this and set x equal to 0. And if I take the 2nth derivative of x to the 2n, what do I get? 2n factorial, right? So this would be the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, gamma of n plus 2/3 over gamma of 2/3. And then there's a 2n factorial from here. And then here's the n factorial. Yeah? OK. Is it, oh, times t to the n. Sorry. Yeah. And this factorial here. Yes, exactly. Very good. Factorial. OK. Now, let's look at this. I see a 2n factorial over an n factorial times an n factorial. So this is just a constant to the n. In fact, we know what that constant is. It's a 4 to the n, because we worked that out before. Okay. But there's another factorial over here. So very roughly speaking, this series has the form n factorial times t to the n. This is a disaster. Why? What's the radius of convergence of that series? 0. This series is absolutely worthless. For the first example, the series at least told me the answer up to t equals 1/4. So for times less than 1/4, this was for this example here, up to times t equals 1/4, that was perfectly good, no problem. But here, the series breaks down instantly. It is of absolutely no value. It's a beautiful form. Look at that. Isn't that a beautiful series? It's of no value because it's divergent. And it diverges for all t except t equals 0. But we don't care about t equals 0 because that's where the initial condition is. We know what happens at t equals 0. Why did it break down? What's wrong with this? Well, the answer is, at t equals 0, my initial condition had singularities already. Therefore, if it could go forward in time, if the series would converge for positive values of t, it would have to converge for negative values of t. But there is no negative value, there is no temperature distribution that can evolve into something like this that is singular. Why? Because diffusion is a smoothing process. Therefore, nothing existed before this. Nothing. And therefore, this Taylor series is a disaster. So the lesson, what's the bottom line? The lesson is you can't use a Taylor series to solve partial differential equations in general. It's a terrible idea. Okay? In rare cases, it might be useful, and it might be useful for proving theorems, but in general, it's a terrible idea. So we need something better than a Taylor series. By the way, why do we want to use a series? Because, you see, when you're trying to solve a problem, when you express the solution to a problem as a series, each term in the series represents a small amount of work. So we have reduced an infinitely hard problem into a sequence of trivial problems. That's why we want to use a series in the first place. But the problem is that we've got to use a series that converges. Okay? So what do we do? And it's really clever. Okay? Now, in elementary partial differential equation courses, they teach you separation of variables. And unless you've had a really, really good course, it's my bet that they didn't explain separation of variables very well to you. Okay? So the question is, what do I mean by separation of variables? Well, I'm going to write down, instead of this Taylor series, I'm going to generalize that Taylor series to a slightly, well, to a very interesting form. What I'm going to do is, you notice there's a function of x here, times t to the n. And I'm going to generalize this to the following series. Okay, I'm going to sum over n. I'm going to have, write down a sub n of x, but in place of t to the n, I will leave that arbitrary, and I'll just call that b sub n of t. This is called a separated variable series. Okay, and why is it called a separated variable series? Because x is over here, and b is over here, so they're separated. Not very deep. Okay. So now, how do you use a separated variable series? How am I going to determine these two functions? Since it's no longer a Taylor series, I cannot use the argument we used when we discussed Taylor series. What was the argument we used when we discussed Taylor series? We said the Taylor coefficients are unique, and therefore, we could compare term by term and powers of t. But this is not a Taylor series. So what principle should I use to determine the function a and b? And it's the simplest possible principle you can imagine. Yeah, what's
your orthogonality of your separation functions?
Well, say it again.
Orthogonality of your...
Oh, no, we don't know anything about orthogonal. We don't know the word orthogonal yet. That has to do with Sturm-Liouville problems. Okay, and we haven't said anything about orthogonality. So here's the principle. And it's so simple that you could cry. We're simply going to say that each term in this series is required to solve the heat equation. Period. Okay, instead of the sum of the series satisfying the heat equation, we're going to require that every single term in this series satisfies the heat equation. Okay? What could be simpler? Of course, it might be so simple that we can't solve the heat equation. Okay? Because that's awfully trivial. But I'm going to require that a of x times b of t solves, so require that this times this solves ut equals uxx. Okay? Yeah.
No guarantee beforehand.
I have no
guarantee.
No, I have no guarantee. This may not work. This could be the dumbest idea because it's so trivial that I may have thrown away all of the interesting solutions to the heat equation. Okay? So it's a guess that I'm going to do. And this comes out of thin air. Okay? I'm just going to guess this. So let's plug it in and see if it's possible for this to actually solve the heat equation. Okay? So on the left side, I take a time derivative, and I have a of x times b prime of t. And on the right side, I have two space derivatives, which gives me a prime prime of x times b of t, right? And then we do the thing that you learned in your elementary partial differential equations course. You divide by ab. Okay? So the equation reads b prime of t over b is equal to a double prime of x over a. And then you argue as follows. You say, the left side of this equation does not depend on x. The right side of this equation does not depend on t. Therefore, whatever this is equal to doesn't depend on either x or t. Doesn't vary with x, doesn't vary with t, so it must be a constant. That constant is called the separation constant, and it's traditional to write this separation constant as minus lambda squared. Okay, I mean, I could write it as anything I like, okay? But I'm going to write it as minus lambda squared. Yeah?
What guarantees that dividing by a, b is valid?
That's right. A and b might be zero, okay? And so what we're going to do is find solutions which are not, we're going to divide by these functions assuming that they're not zero, and at isolated points where they are zero, okay, at isolated points where there are zero, we have to treat that separately. Okay, but you're going to see that it turns out we're not throwing away anything of interest. Okay, all of the interesting solutions are still here. Okay. So now I solve this differential equation for b, and the solution is b of t is equal to e to the minus lambda squared t. And I solve the equation for A, and I find that times this is times some constant. There's a T here, times some constant. Okay? And I solve this equation here for A, and I see that A is equal to sine of lambda x, A of x, is equal to sine of lambda x times some constant, call it capital A or something like that, plus some other constant times cosine of lambda x. Okay? So what is a solution? So I have a solution to the heat equation of the form sum of A sine lambda x, that's a lambda, plus B cosine lambda x, okay, times e to the minus lambda squared t. Does lambda have to be an integer or something? No. We don't know anything about lambda. Nothing at all. Okay? Now over here, I wrote down, it looks like a sum over integers, but it isn't really a sum over integers. It's a sum over any number lambda. It could even be an integral d lambda. Okay? All of these constants are functions of lambda, a lambda, b lambda. So this is a sum over lambda. It could be integers, but it might be half integers, might be irrational numbers. So this is a very, very general solution to the heat equation. Okay? And every single term in this sum satisfies the heat equation. Okay? Now, I'm going to give you a slightly harder problem. Over here, you see I've written down the solution to the Cauchy problem. That means solving the heat equation for all x and for all t. But I'm going to consider now a much harder problem. I'm going to consider the heat equation problem on a finite domain. So what do I mean by a finite domain? This is x, this is t, and for a finite domain, I'm going to solve the heat equation between x equals 0 and x equals pi. Okay, so this is the region where I want to solve it. Okay, so I want to solve it in this region. So I imagine that I have a wire, okay, that transports heat, okay, that conducts heat. Here is x equals 0. Here is x equals pi, okay? And I will impose, I will take the simplest possible case. Let's say that T is equal to 0, the temperature, that U is equal to 0, that is, the temperature is equal to 0 at the left side of the wire, and that the temperature is equal to 0 at the right side of the wire. Okay? That's the simplest possible boundary condition I can impose. These are homogeneous boundary conditions. And these sorts of boundary conditions have a fancy name. This is called a Dirichlet boundary condition. Okay? But this is a very simple heat equation problem with homogeneous boundary conditions. And I also have to give an initial condition. So what I'm saying is U of pi and T is equal to 0. U of 0 and t is equal to 0 for all t. And here is where I pose my initial condition. I say u of x and 0 is equal to some given function, f of x, for x between 0 and pi. OK? So this is the problem that I'm going to focus on. OK. Now, the question is, can we solve that problem? Well, we look at all of the terms in this sum, and we say we could solve this problem only if this thing here as a function of x vanishes when x is equal to 0, and if it vanishes when x is equal to pi. How do we make it vanish when x equals 0? You require that B, so this condition tells us that B, all of these coefficients B, must be 0. OK? That's how we make, sorry. This requires that B is equal to 0. That's how we make it vanish at x equals 0. How do we make it vanish at x equals pi, B equals 0? OK. So to make it vanish here, we would have to require that sine of lambda times pi is equal to 0. But we know how to do that. We require that lambda is equal to n, an integer, OK? Where n is equal to 1, 2, 3, da-da-da. So out of all these possible solutions, you see that we can solve the heat equation problem on this finite domain if we require that B is equal to 0 and lambda is equal to n. So the solution to our problem, the general solution to our problem, would be as follows. U of x and t is the sum from n equals 1 to infinity, a sub n, OK, instead of writing a of lambda, I'm writing a sub n, okay, because lambda is only an integer n, e to the minus n squared t times sine of nx. What have we discovered? We have discovered a Fourier series. Okay? And what I really want to talk to you about is Fourier series and how they work. Let's figure out what parts of the problem we have solved. Number one, every single term in this series satisfies the heat equation. So ut equals uxx. Check. We have solved that part of the equation. Furthermore, we have imposed the condition that u of 0 and t is equal to u of pi and t is equal to 0. Check. Every single term in that series satisfies that equation. There's only one thing left to do, and that is to require that u of x and 0 is equal to f of x. OK? Our initial condition. OK? So what do? I set t equal to 0, And I require that f of x, okay, f of x, my initial condition, is equal to the sum from n equals 1 to infinity a sub n, sine of nx. There we go. This is the problem. This problem has fascinated mathematicians for centuries. This is an extraordinarily difficult problem. Because you understand what the problem is, you are given the function f. And given the function f, you have to find the numbers a sub n. That's a very, very deep and difficult problem, and a very non-trivial problem. And that's what I'm going to be talking to you about for the next lecture and a half. Okay? Because this is an absolutely fascinating problem. But let me emphasize the difference between a Fourier series solution. This is called the Fourier series. Let me emphasize the difference between a Fourier series solution and a Taylor series solution. Okay? You have a question.
Make n equals minus number.
Oh, because that's redundant. Okay, if we let n be negative, then it's the same as n being, it's you could combine minus 1 and plus 1 into a term of the form plus 1. Okay, because sine of minus x is minus sine of x. So if you want to put in a term of the form n equals minus 1, it would just be exactly the same as a term with n equals plus 1. You know, you'd have some coefficient a plus 1 and a minus 1, and you just combine those two terms into a1. Okay, you see that? Yeah, okay.
Because one time...
There should be... I didn't get it.
AX and BT equals sigma lambda is n.
Yes, yes, but lambda has now become an integer n,
yes,
because of the condition that sine, the only possible lambda is an integer n.
Right. But here at UXT, there is another sigma n to over IN, BN terms. At the first law, UXT equals sigma n.
You only solve for one term of the series at the top of the board.
Yes, here.
Yeah, but there is another sigma n here. Right.
Where's the other sigma?
UXT equals sigma n.
That's what's written there.
I really don't understand your question. Do you understand what he's asking?
I think so.
Yeah, okay.
But I have the same question.
Yeah.
So there we suppose that the solution is of a sum of terms of the form ax plus bt. Call it
times.
Right.
Yeah. A sub n of x times.
Right. So we decided that every term of that series should satisfy the heat equation.
Right. So, and that's not a bad idea, because the heat equation is a linear equation.
Right. So we've took one term of the series, mm-hmm. call it a naught, b naught.
Right.
And we solved for a naught times b naught in
right.
the form of that series, that sum over lambda. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now we need to solve. Don't we?
What I'm doing is I'm imposing. See, since I don't know a better way to do it, I'm imposing these boundary conditions, term by term.
Yeah.
I'm imposing these boundary conditions for each single term in the series. So each single term in this series. Each one of the single terms in the series satisfies three things: the differential equation, the left boundary condition, and the right boundary condition.
The way you've written it there with the lambdas, it looks like that's a single answer, when really that's the sum of all.
That's the sum. Well, yeah. That's the
this here.
It looks everybody
this
thinks
is
that's just a single term in that sum above.
But actually,
really, that's all the
this is a sum over all possible lambda.
Yes.
Or an interval
that
over
is equal
all
to
possible.
UX,
is that clear?
Yes, that's very clear. That's the problem.
Why?
Because that is written, or for all we know, that could be just a single AX, BT.
This could either be a sum, or it could be an interval
certainly.
Over lambda. Okay, is that clear?
Very clear.
Yeah.
Except we don't know whether that is AX, BT for one single term in the above series.
Yeah.
Or whether that's all.
This is
that's
a of x. this is right. The...
Perhaps it would be clearer if we wrote...
I'm sorry. I guess I'm completely dense here, because I have no idea what's bothering me. But somebody who is coherent, would you please explain to me what is the problem?
So the confusion, okay. 0 at the top, u of x and t, is the sum over n of a n times b and t. At the
I can't
top.
Hear you, because more than one person is talking. Okay. So
at the very
since you understand, please explain to me.
Yes,
yeah,
so at the very top of the board, you have u of x of t
is
the sum of that line over there.
That's right. Okay.
And then on the bottom of the right, you have the sum over lambda.
Right.
Because, now the confusion, yes.
Okay, because I assume initially that if I go from a Taylor series to a separated variable series, a Taylor series is a sum over integer numbers.
Yes.
But over here, I discover that these numbers don't have to be integers. They can be anything. Okay. So instead of an integer, n is being replaced by a continuous variable lambda, which is the separation constant.
Yes.
So instead of summing over n, I'm summing over separation constants, which can be anything.
Yes.
Okay.
The confusion was whether the sum over lambda was a single a n b n terms, and then you had sum over
so,
n,
no,
sum over lambda.
Sorry. There is no n. There's only lambda.
I know, and that's where
what's
the confusion
that?
Came from.
Yeah.
What's that?
So,
this is either a sum over lambda or an integral over lambda.
But it's
we don't know what lambda is.
I think everyone understands.
Yeah.
So
what? All of this, all of this is under the sum. Is that clear?
Yes.
Okay.
What is that whole sum or integral equal to?
U x t.
U x comma t.
This is supposed to be equal to u of x t.
Thank you.
Yes. Which
is
what
that
the confusion
question?
Yes. Yes. That's where the confusion was.
Yes. That's the solution to the problem.
Well, some people thought that might have been just one single term in a series about that. So just an a sub n times a sub n.
No. This is the solution to the differential equation problem.
We know.
Okay. All right. Okay. Yes, you have a question.
I think it's better to describe it this way. If you do not use n lambda equals n, maybe you choose lambda equals to n. Then there should be
lambda is not n. Lambda is completely arbitrary.
Yeah.
There is no condition on lambda.
So
lambda could be any complex number.
Okay.
Any complex number, and I'm summing over a continuum, possibly a continuum of lambdas.
Yeah,
this general thing here, where a is a function of lambda and b is a function of lambda, solves the heat equation.
I mean, here is just one term of the series.
No, that's all the terms.
No, this is the solution to the heat equation. This is the most general solution to the heat equation.
There are two sums. One is sum over n, and the one is sum over
n. The sum over n has been generalized to an integral or a continuous sum over lambda. Because n doesn't have to be an integer, is what we learned. We thought from the form of a Taylor series that it might be an integer. But in fact, we found that n does not have to be an integer. So we replace n by the continuous parameter lambda. Because for any lambda, what is your favorite number?
For example, m.
No, that's not a number. No, that's not a number. That's a variable.
I mean.
No, I want to know your favorite number.
Okay, for example, 7.
7. Okay, if lambda equals 7, then this thing in here with lambda equals 7 solves the heat equation. Give me another number. How about pi?
Nice.
If lambda is equal to pi, this thing in here is a solution to the heat equation. If lambda is equal to 91.3, that is a solution to the heat equation. Is that clear?
Okay. May I say one thing?
Yes.
Perhaps. Okay. So, as you said, we've solved for a and b n, and now we have to sum over n.
Right.
However, notice that this is, so now we have the sum over n, sum over lambda, a n, b, you know, a blah, blah, blah.
No,
just get me out. Okay.
Hold on a second. We're wasting time.
Yeah.
I hope you understand what I've written down here. I started with the Taylor series. I generalized it to something of this type. and found that it generalizes even further, not to a sum over discrete integers n, but to sum over a continuous parameter lambda. And for any value of lambda, this, each term in this sum over lambda, is a solution to the heat equation. And because the heat equation is linear, any sum over this is still a solution to the heat equation. So this is a very general solution. So for each term in this sum over lambda, or integral over lambda, that solves the heat equation. But then I said, let me solve the heat equation on a finite domain and impose boundary conditions. Then I said, is it possible that not only every term in this sum satisfies the heat equation, but also it satisfies the homogeneous boundary condition? If that is the case, then I learned that lambda must be n. Okay? And further, so then I learned that this right here is the most general form of the solution to the heat equation, satisfying this condition, and the equation ut equals uxx. There's only one thing that we have not solved for, and that is the initial value problem. Okay, we have not put the initial condition in, and the initial condition can only be inserted into the problem by solving this equation. Is that clear? I hope this is clear. Okay, what is the difference between a Taylor series solution and a Fourier series solution? They are absolutely opposites of one another. Because in the case of a Taylor series, we are given an initial condition, and we put this initial condition in, and before we even begin work on the problem, we say that a0 of x is equal to f of x. Done. The initial condition is now included in the solution. How do we solve the equation, the differential equation? We have to solve it by determining the coefficients so that they satisfy a recursion relation. Okay? So it's not any given term that solves the heat equation. It's only the sum of all the terms that solves the heat equation. But in the case of a separated variable series, every term solves the heat equation. And the difficult part is putting in the initial condition, namely this. Okay? That's the difference. So the heat equation solution, the heat equation can be solved in two completely different ways. But we didn't like the Taylor way. So we're going to try the separated variable series way. Yes?
Regardless of procedure, is there a way to figure out whether or not you've missed any solutions that maybe you can't recursion like that?
Not yet. So we don't know. Because we were so naive, we said, you know, we could have pairs of terms solving the heat equation, or triples of terms. But we didn't do that. We simply said, I want each term individually to solve the heat equation, and each term individually to satisfy these boundary conditions. And that is a very, very powerful constraint on our part, and we may have thrown away the baby with the bathwater. Okay? The solution that we're looking for may be impossible to find because this may be too strict a condition. Amazingly, it isn't too strict. That's why I'm telling you about it, of course. Okay? So the question is, how do you solve how do you take an equation like this, given the function f of x, how do you find a sub n? And this is a very, very, very deep problem. However, in an elementary course on PDEs, you're told what to do right away. What are you told? Of what?
Of the basis functions.
You don't mean linear dependence. You mean orthogonality. Okay. So there is a fact about these sine functions. They happen to be orthogonal. Okay, and what does that mean? It means that if you integrate from 0 to pi dx sine of nx times sine of mx, what do you get? Delta nm times times pi over 2. Okay? So then this is what you were taught in an elementary course on PDEs. You were told, multiply both sides of this equation by sine of mx and integrate from 0 to pi. The right-hand side vanishes except when n is equal to m. The left-hand side is an integral. So what you get is the integral from 0 to pi dx times f of x times sine of mx is equal to, over here, you get pi over 2 times a sub m. OK? It's very straightforward. You divide off by 2 over pi, and that's a sub m. OK? Done. We have found the coefficients. And the answer to that is not so fast. Why? What's the problem here? Yeah?
We technically only found it up to discontinuities. If there are discontinuities.
Oh, don't use fancy words.
No, I mean, if there's a function, then.
We just multiply, then we integrate.
So we have.
The problem is, what justified integrating term by term in this series? How do you know that this series converges fast enough that if you multiply by sine of mx, you can do each integral term by term? You can do the integral corresponding to n equals 1, then n equals 2, n equals 3. How do you know that's justified? You don't know whether or not this series converges. This is a really, really serious problem. How do you justify multiplying and then integrating term by term? You don't know that you can do that. Of course, there's nothing wrong with the left-hand side. You're allowed to take the function sine of mx, multiply it by the function f of x, and if the integral exists, the integral exists. It's just one integral. But on the right-hand side, how do you know that you can interchange orders of summation and integration? That's completely unjustified because we don't know a priori whether or not the series is convergent to justify that. So we have a really serious problem. And in fact, there are three problems that we have to answer. The first problem is, yeah?
But sine is no longer true. You can change its summation and integration.
Oh, no. It's not a question of sine being smooth. This is an infinite series. It's a question of how big these numbers A are. If these numbers are pretty big, then this series is not a uniformly convergent series. And we don't know that we can integrate term by term. You can't perform an operation on a series term by term. You're not allowed to do that unless the series is sufficiently rapidly convergent. And we don't know how rapidly convergent this series is. We have no idea. Okay? So here's what we're going to do. So let me pose the three questions that we need to answer. Question number one, given the function f of x, can we find a sequence of numbers a sub n that can be constructed from this function? This might be the correct formula, and it might not be. But we got this formula without justifying it, because we interchanged orders of integration and summation. So the first question is, how do we find the numbers a sub n? The second question is, given that we have found the numbers, once we have found the numbers a sub n, we need to know whether or not this series converges. It might not converge. And the third question is the most subtle question. How do you know whether or not this series converges to the function f of x? It might converge to a different function. OK? So this is very, very subtle. And the question is, how do we address these three separate questions? OK? And the trick is how you even begin, okay? Because you understand this is a circular question. The logic is completely circular. Without knowing the A's, how do we know whether or not this series is convergent rapidly enough to justify integrating term by term to get this formula? Yes?
The space of square integrable functions on an interval is Hilbert space.
Hilbert space, Schmilbert space. We're just talking about, we're physicists. And we're not going to talk, I mean, we can go into very deep problems involving convergence of sequences in Hilbert space and whether or not the Hilbert space is separable and so on and so on. But we're not asking, that's, you have merely rephrased my question.
Right, but it is, so my question is, if you know that it's a Hilbert space, then can you just immediately say if that is
square? It's a Hilbert space, but I haven't said anything about Hilbert space. I have posed the question. It may be that you can bring Hilbert space theory to bear on this question and use very, very powerful Hilbert space methods. But in fact, it's not so simple. This question has kept mathematicians busy for many, many, many decades. Okay? And only very recently have people been able to answer this question. This is a very, very non-trivial question. Just saying it's a Hilbert space and you can't say some magic words and expect the solution to be there. It's really a very deep question. So we're going to go, that's what I want to talk to you about. So this is how we're going to perform the analysis. Okay. Yeah?
Very trivial question. What is that simple next step, f of that step?
Dx.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, that's my, I'm just showing off my writing, okay? So, how do we address the question? Well, I'm going to finesse question one. Question one is, how do we determine the A sub n? So the answer to question one is, I'm going to define the Fourier coefficients as this formula. Okay, now this is a very, very subtle thing that I'm doing, okay? I'm not telling you where this came from. It certainly didn't come from taking this equation and multiplying by sine of x and integrating, because I couldn't justify that. So I'm going to give you a definition. The Fourier coefficients for the function f of x are given by this formula. And that is going to be the answer to question one. I simply define A sub m to be this. Okay? And here, there is no problem, because this is a freshman calculus question. This doesn't address questions of Hilbert space or anything like this. It merely asks the question, does the integral of f of x times sine of mx exist? And if it exists, then that's, I'm going to say, the formula for the mth Fourier coefficient. Boom, we've answered question one. But of course, now we have question two and three. Question two is, does the sum of a sub n sine of nx converge? We don't know whether or not that converges using this definition of the Fourier coefficient. We don't know whether or not that converges. And the second, the last question is, does this converge to f of x? Because it might not. Just because the series converges doesn't mean it converges to the function that you want it to converge to. It might converge to a different function. Okay? So these are the two questions that we need to answer. Okay, so let's think about question number two. Does this converge? Well, certainly, in order to converge, it's certainly necessary that a sub n has to go to 0 as n goes to infinity. If the Fourier coefficients did not go to 0 as n goes to infinity, then we would be in trouble. Then it's not likely that this series would converge. Okay, yeah? Yes, very, very much. Okay, and there are various possibilities, and that's what I want to talk about right now. Okay, so the first possibility is that this series is absolutely convergent. Second question is it uniformly convergent? Okay, is it absolutely convergent? Is it uniformly convergent? Or is it non-uniformly convergent? Is it a very delicate kind of convergence? So let's try to understand what those words mean. What does absolutely convergent mean? If you have a series of the form A sub n, what does it mean that when you say it's absolutely convergent, what does that mean?
Pointwise.
No, there's no points. This is just a series of numbers. What does it mean if it's absolutely convergent? Yeah.
That the series that is the absolute value of
right.
A,
that's
a
right.
Then converges as well.
That's right. That's right. It is absolutely convergent. This series is absolutely convergent if the sum of A sub n is convergent. Okay? It is perfectly possible for a series to be convergent, but not to be absolutely convergent. An example would be the sum of minus 1 to the n over n. That's a convergent series. If you add it up, you get log of 2. But it is not absolutely convergent. This is equal to log of 2 if you sum from 1 to infinity, minus 1 to the n plus 1. Okay, that's equal to log of 2. But if you take the absolute value, the sum of 1 over n, that's divergent. That adds up to infinity. Okay? So this series may or may not be absolutely convergent. What does uniformly convergent? Okay, what does that mean? Yeah?
Means that we don't get to pick a different delta and epsilon for every point x in our definition of the limit.
Exactly, exactly. So when you say the series is uniformly convergent, you mean that the rate of convergence is not sensitive to the value x. It converges for, you choose a value x, and it gets the partial sums approach a limit, and that limit is independent of the choice of x. Okay? But it might depend on the choice of x. We don't know. Okay? So that's what uniformly convergent. Absolutely convergent just refers to a series of numbers. Uniformly convergent refers to a series of functions. Okay? But we certainly know that it must be that a sub n goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. This is not sufficient to guarantee that the series converges, but it certainly is necessary. Because if the a sub n did not go to 0, then we would have a disaster. And I'm going to quote one theorem at you, which is the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. The Riemann-Lebesgue lemma says that a sub n goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. Okay, now why is that true? I'm not going to prove the theorem to you. This is something that you can read about if you're interested. Okay, but here's the definition of a sub n. If n, or m, is getting big, you can see that the sine function is oscillating very, very rapidly. So it contributes positive numbers to this integral and negative numbers. And as it oscillates faster and faster, there's a cancellation between the positive contribution and the negative contribution. When you add them all up, it goes to 0. That's the heuristic understanding of the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. OK? Yeah? Yes. So you want, in order to prove the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma, you want f to be integrable. And it is probably sufficient for it to be absolutely integrable. Just f of x to be absolutely integrable. That's enough. OK? And it's even stronger if you require that f of x be continuous. Okay, if f of x is continuous, then the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma is true. And we're only going to really talk about continuous functions f of x. Okay? So the question is, so the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma is a very powerful lemma. And it tells us that this series converges. But the question is, what does the convergence look like? Okay, how does a series of this type look? And the question is, even if the series converges, does it converge to the right answer? And I want to show you what the series actually does. Okay. Can he see? Oh, he's turning it on. Okay. Okay. So this is the Fourier series that we're talking about. Okay? And I'm going to give you two different examples. The first example, so here's the formula that we're going to use to calculate the Fourier series coefficients. This is the mth coefficient. Okay? And let's take as an example, let's take the function x times pi minus x. Why did I choose this function? Because you notice that this function vanishes at x equals 0, and the function vanishes at x equals pi, okay, vanishes at x equals 0, vanishes at x equals pi. If you evaluate the integral for the Fourier series coefficients, you just use integration by parts twice, and you find that this is the formula for the nth Fourier coefficient. Okay, so if n is odd, the coefficient is 8 over pi n cubed. And if n is even, it happens to be 0. Okay? Notice that these Fourier coefficients are vanishing like n cubed. Therefore, can you answer the question, is this series uniformly convergent, and is it absolutely convergent? Sorry? It certainly is absolutely convergent, because if you take the absolute value of sine could either be sine of nx could either be positive or negative. But if you take the absolute value, it's now a positive number between 0 and 1. And an upper bound on that number is certainly 1. But the series 1 over n cubed, that's a rapidly convergent series, no problem. So the series is absolutely convergent, and it's uniformly convergent because it doesn't depend on x. Okay? So for this function here, the series is uniformly convergent, absolutely convergent. That's great. And if you look at a picture, this is what the partial sums in the series look like. Okay? So you have to look carefully here. The function x times pi minus x, the function we are trying to represent by a Fourier series, is the one that's it's right over here. It's the one that's in between the top curve and the bottom curve. Okay? If you take just one term in the Fourier series, you get this curve here, which is a pretty darn good approximation, just one term. If you take two terms in the Fourier series, look how much closer it gets. Now, you notice what happens. Over here, the Fourier series is a little bit below the exact answer. It's a tiny bit below. Whereas over here, it's a tiny bit above. Okay? But you notice the Fourier series is an extraordinarily good approximation. And I have not included in this picture a three-term Fourier series. Why? Because there's no point. You can't see the difference on a graph. Okay, so this is a wonderful way to represent the function x times pi minus x. We have represented the function very well. And what you see is two things. Number one, the answer to the second question, Q2, okay, is that the Fourier series is clearly very rapidly convergent. It's uniformly convergent, and it's absolutely convergent. And from this picture, you can see that that series is clearly converging to the function. Not only converging, but it's converging to the function that it represents. So now here is the interesting part of Fourier series. Let's take, as a second example, let's take the function f of x equals 1. Okay? Now we're trying to represent the function 1 by a Fourier series. Now the function 1 is a continuous function. It's a perfectly nice function. The Fourier coefficients exist, okay? So if I calculate the Fourier series a sub n sine of nx, and I calculate these functions for the number 1, what will happen? Because you notice that every term in this series is 0 at x equals 0 and at x equals pi, whereas the number 1, the function 1, is 1 at x equals 0 and at x equals pi. So the Fourier series cannot converge, you would think, cannot converge to the function 1. But in fact, it does. But it does in an extraordinarily interesting way. Okay? So if you take f of x equals 1, a sub n, the Fourier coefficients, are just 4 over pi times n. Okay? You take these coefficients, and you plug them into the Fourier series, and you make a plot. Now, question 1, is the Fourier, so this Fourier series, the nth term in this Fourier series, the nth term here is of order, is some constant times 1 over n. Is this series absolutely convergent? No. This series, if it converges, can only converge because part of the time sine is contributing a positive number, and part of the time sine is contributing a negative number. Because if I were to take the absolute value of this, this clearly diverges, because the sum of 1 over n diverges. So this is a delicately convergent series if it converges. So it certainly does not converge absolutely. And in fact, although it's not obvious, it also does not converge uniformly. But amazingly, it converges to 1. And the question is, how does it converge to 1? And it looks like this. OK. So if you take 5 terms in the Fourier series and you look at the sum, what it does is this. It starts at 0, it goes up, and it oscillates about the function 1. And as it gets toward the center of the region, these oscillations get smaller and smaller until you get to the middle of the region. Then they begin to get a little bit bigger, and then they come up, and then they come down to 0 at pi. Why does it go down to 0? Because every single term in the series vanishes at pi, and every single term in the series vanishes at 0. Okay? Now, suppose we take 20 terms in the series. What you see is that it rises up, it hits a peak here, it then oscillates, okay, closer, much, much closer to the number 1. The oscillations get bigger, and then it comes down and reaches 0. What happens now if we take 80 terms in the Fourier series? If you take 80 terms, it starts at 0, it goes up and hits a peak, okay? That is, it overshoots the number 1. What is the size of the overshoot? Does anybody know?
1.3 times the...
Not 1.3.
0.3 times the...
No. It's... No, it's a very famous, it's too big. I mean, it's not, that's not the number. The number is 18%. Okay, it overshoots by this very famous number. This, it should approach the number 1, but it doesn't. It overshoots by 18%. The height of this peak, you notice this is pretty level. You notice this peak, it's almost, those peaks are almost the same. So it comes up, it overshoots by 18%, so this peak is 1.18 instead of 1.0. But then it comes down, and it oscillates with very, very, very tiny oscillations, okay, all the way until it reaches the other end. Then you see these oscillations beginning to grow over here. They get bigger and bigger. It overshoots by 18%, and then it comes down again. So you see that the convergence is not uniform. Why is it not uniform? Because in the center of the interval, these wiggles are very, very close to the function 1. But as you get to the edge of the interval, you notice that the wiggles get bigger and bigger and bigger, and they get so that it the rate of convergence depends on the value of x, delicately on the value of x. And as you get near the end of the interval, it overshoots. Okay, you have this bad oscillation. This oscillation has a name. The oscillation is called the Gibbs phenomenon. And most people, when they teach Fourier series, teach the Gibbs phenomenon as a bad property of Fourier series. It is a clumsy property of Fourier series. What I'm going to show you in the next lecture is that it is not a bad property of Fourier series. In fact, the Gibbs phenomenon occurs because the Fourier series converges very slowly. Aha! What am I talking about in this course? I'm talking about the acceleration of convergence. What I'm going to show you how to do is take a Fourier series, which is converging very, very slowly. Notice here we had to take 80 terms to get a decent, even a vaguely decent representation of the number 1. And I'm going to teach you how to take just a few terms in that series and, bang, make it converge. Furthermore, I'm going to show you that the non-uniform convergence of Fourier series is not a bad thing, contrary to what you're taught in virtually every course that you take on Fourier series. It is a wonderful thing, because the Gibbs phenomenon, this subtle, subtle phenomenon, which I'm going to explain to you next time, allows you to solve problems using Fourier series that are extremely difficult and that you cannot solve except with a Fourier series that is not uniformly convergent. So what I'm, in the next week in this course, I'm going to be explaining to you that by accelerating convergence, that justifies our using perturbation theory to solve hard problems, say in quantum mechanics or other theories. But this week, I'm talking to you about acceleration of convergence. The Fourier series converges, but it converges horribly slowly. And I'm going to show you that the Fourier series, the rate of convergence of the Fourier series, can be improved dramatically. And so we can use Fourier series to solve hard problems. Yeah?
Can you say a series converges to 1 if it always disagrees with the endpoints, unless you're only talking about the open interval?
Wonderful question. And except at that single point at the end, it actually converges to 1.
So as
we take more and more terms, as we take more and more terms in the series, what does the Fourier series converge to? It converges, so here's pi, here's 0, okay? And it's converging to 1 on an interval between 0 and pi. And as we take more and more terms in the series, this interval approaches the end. It goes outward toward the end. And when n reaches infinity, I can't see the difference. So if I start in the middle of the interval and work my way out to the end, or start here in the interval and work my way out to the end, I see that the sum of the series is approaching 1. Okay? And I'm going to prove to you that the Fourier series actually converges to 1. This is a very, very non-trivial and very beautiful proof. Okay? So I will actually show that to you. Yeah?
It's a little bit pedantic, but what metric are you actually using?
Okay, so we can talk about many kinds of convergence. This is not a pedantic question. It's an important question. We can talk about point-wise convergence. We can talk about convergence in mean and so on. There are many ways to measure convergence. What I am talking about is point-wise convergence. Okay? So what I'm saying is that for a given value of x between 0 and pi, if I calculate the partial sum of the Fourier series for that value of x, it will approach 1, or it will approach the function that you're trying to represent by a Fourier series. It will not approach 1 when x is equal to 0. It will approach 0 in that case. However, if we start at the middle of the interval and work our way outward, you know, it approaches 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. When I get to the edge of the interval, the limit of 1, 1, 1, 1 is 1. Okay. So in fact, I have expanded the function 1 what I say is I have expanded the function 1 everywhere on the interval from 0 to pi. In that sense, that's the sense in which I mean that it converges to 1. Okay. Yeah?
So you're not claiming that the sum of the series actually is 1 at the endpoint?
I'm going to show you how it works. I'm not claiming that.
Okay.
So this has to do with an order in which you take limits. So if you first set x equal to 0, and then you take the limit as n goes to infinity, clearly the Fourier series converges, and it converges to 0, because it's 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0, whose sum is 0. But if you take x equal to epsilon, okay, and sum the series, and then let epsilon approach 0, the sum is 1. So in effect, what I'm telling you is that 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0 plays the role of 1. Okay? This is a very subtle distinction. And the reason is what we are going to do is this. We're going to solve. What we are going to do is I'm going to show you how to solve not this trivial boundary value problem, which I've just solved for you, but I'm going to put in some function g of t over here and some function h of t over here. This is an extraordinarily difficult problem. And I'm going to show you that we can solve this with a Fourier series. And as you start at the center of the interval and go out, the sum of the Fourier series will approach g. And as you start at the center and you go outward to the edge, it will approach h. So even though the Fourier series, strictly speaking, at the boundary, adds up to 0 here and adds up to 0 here, the Fourier series knows that the function, the solution to our differential equation problem, must approach g, and it does, and must approach h, and it does. This is really subtle. Okay, this is where we're heading. And we cannot solve this problem. It's absolutely impossible to solve this problem without knowing how to accelerate convergence. So in effect, what I've done is I've done two steps. One, I've taken this very, very hard problem and reduced it to a sum of terms in a Fourier series. So I've reduced the problem down to a finite number of easy calculations. And the second part, the part where acceleration of convergence comes in, is that I can then extract the answer of that problem by accelerating the convergence of the series. And I will make the convergence, instead of non-uniform, I will make the convergence uniform. It's very hard to believe that I can do this, okay? And I'm going to show you that we can do that. This is the part of Fourier series that never gets taught. And this is the reason why Fourier series are good. Okay, this is because very few people understand the notion of acceleration of convergence. So when you take a course on it, you just learn the formalism, but it's worthless. Okay. Yeah.
How come we don't include cosines
We don't need to use cosines on the interval from 0 to pi. Had I taken an interval from minus pi to pi, I would have had to use cosines. But there wouldn't be anything new. It would just mean that I'd have to write twice as many expressions on the blackboard. But it wouldn't contain anything new. You understand, of course, that the interval from 0 to pi is completely general, because I can always translate from the, you know, to the left or to the right. And I can scale. I can, replace pi. But I mean, you know that pi approaches 3 in the limit of small circles, right?
Yeah.
So you can scale pi. You can scale this interval and make it as big as you like. You could make it range from 0 to a. And then you can move that interval from minus 17 up to 17 plus a.
I know that in a formal sense it's redundant, but I guess what I was asking is, would it help us with, say...
No. The cosine series also has the same Gibbs phenomenon, the same problems with non-uniform convergence, but I don't want to contradict myself. It's not a problem with uniform convergence, non-uniform. Non-uniform convergence is a very, very good thing, because it is the crack in the door that allows us to put this information into the Fourier series. You would think you couldn't possibly represent a function that is non-zero using a Fourier series, and we can. That's the point. Okay. I think we should stop here, because otherwise we're going to step on Sid Redner's toes.